You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. On today's episode, we head to the capital of Scotland in the company of Graham Milne, ghost tour guide. Edinburgh is a city with an almost unmatched paranormal reputation, built on top of a bloody and shocking history. Graham cut his teeth collecting ghost stories from Aberdeenshire before moving on to Edinburgh. From a haunted bus station with an abandoned hospital wing, an aptly named haunted pub, a forgotten mummy's curse, and a violent attack in a library, there's much more to those ghosts in Edinburgh than meets the eye. Graham acts as a great guide as we finally go on the hunt for the supernatural in one of Britain's most beautiful cities. But before that, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, competitions, and more. Thank you to Heather, my latest patron. Your support, along with everybody else, is greatly appreciated. Mysteries and Monsters is on all social media platforms. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Mastodon, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes, news, and merchandise. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. So we head to Edinburgh in the company of the marvellous Graham Milne on the hunt for the city's paranormal history. On this episode, we make a long overdue return to Scotland on the hunt for some of the country's most notable hauntings. Joining me to chill our blood is author and ghost tour host Graham Milne to regale us with some deliciously creepy stories. Graham, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Hi, Paul. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm delighted. It's always a pleasure discovering authors and people such as yourself that I've never been aware of, and then I discover your work, and I kick myself thinking, why on earth was I not aware of this gentleman?
Thank you. That's very kind.
So, Graham, as I mentioned in the introduction, You are someone that does some of the best reviewed ghost tours on TripAdvisor, I've noticed. Often.
Thank you, yes.
Complimented for your knowledge and your humour.
Yes.
How on earth did the paranormal pull you in? Because ghost tours in Edinburgh are synonymous. They are big business. There are a lot about. There are a lot to do. Edinburgh has a vast history of hauntings and paranormal locations all over. So I suspect, personally, it's probably the toughest market in Britain to be a ghost tour host.
Yes. It was a strange set of circumstances. I actually moved down here probably permanently at least around about 5 years ago. And my background was in sort of museum education and tours and talks, that kind of history talks, social history. And I always had an interest in the paranormal. And believe it or not, when I arrived here, I couldn't find work. Up came this advert, and it was for a sort of free tour company. And basically, I had to send in a regaling a story and, you know, filmed by one of the guy's assistants. And if they kind of thought you were reasonably pleasant looking or could film the public or could tell a good story, you got a chance at the gig. And they basically put you on ghost tours first because the ghost tours are kind of like, well, literally the twilight shift at night. And so you would get to do the ghost tours. And once you'd kind of got yourself up to speed, you might be then offered, you know, like old town history tours or what have you. So I fell into it accidentally. But it is an interesting thing because it's actually quite, sometimes it can be quite depressing for somebody who's really interested in the subject, because about 90% of people that come in a ghost tour aren't really that interested. You know, they're kind of there because it's kind of expected of them to do a ghost tour while in a city like Edinburgh.
Yeah. Well, it was very interesting. I had a friend of mine who moved to York a few years ago, Graham, which is obviously, along with Edinburgh, I've said this before on previous episodes, these two cities jostle about which is the most haunted in Britain. Is it York? Is it Edinburgh? And I think, to be fair, they both have embraced their paranormal history to such a level now that they're synonymous with ghosts, really.
Yes.
And in all the time he lived there about 3 years, we never did the ghost tour. Ever. I'd done it a few years ago before he'd moved there. So we made a point of not doing it. I mean, we drank in a few renowned local haunted hotspots in York. But I suppose, like you say, when you come to a city as beautiful as Edinburgh, really it's also, not only is it a great way to hear some history and some of the stories about it, it's a great way to see some of the city's most beautiful locations as well.
Yes. No, that's true. There's kind of an expectation. It's quite an odd one. When people come on a ghost tour, you know, I mean, I often start by saying, I shouldn't really, because it probably puts people really off. Has anybody had an experience, or has anybody really, you know, is anybody interested in the paranormal? Which I think is a fair question. And often you just get looked by this sea of puzzled faces. But there's always a few people, and you always kind of get drawn to their energy a little more, and they're a bit more kind of into the idea. And the funny thing is, I always say to people, what I'm going to tell you tonight is true, because I do try and stick to stories that I know have some real basis for, you know, legends being haunted, as opposed to, you know, the sort of fantastical ones. And people look at you very suspiciously, as if you're kind of trying to pull the wool over their eyes. But I do genuinely try and tell people what I consider to be stories about genuinely haunted locations. But I don't know if they believe me. It's just one of these things.
Well, yeah. I mean, and obviously, before you rocked up in Edinburgh, you'd obviously written a couple of books about the paranormal, focusing on Aberdeen, which is a city that gets overlooked when we talk about the hauntings and ghosts of Scotland, I think, Graham, because it's not Glasgow and Edinburgh, and it's not a scene of a famous battle, or there's not a notorious castle there. So Aberdeen has probably as much paranormal history as Edinburgh, does it not?
Yeah, it's roughly the same age as Edinburgh. It's you know, about half the size of population wise, but it's certainly, it kind of looked similar to Edinburgh in certain respects back in the day. So obviously now it's been completely changed. It's got some great buildings, lots of, like Edinburgh, you know, Edinburgh city centre with the Market Cross was a scene for punishments and all sorts of brutal tortures, exactly the same in Aberdeen, except the Castlegate area was their equivalent. And so it has got a lot of keynote buildings still here today, but there are many that were knocked down. And a dark history typically of Scotland. So yeah, there's been lots of strange things there. But like you say, they don't really, you know, advertise it. Nobody ever goes online and thinks, oh, Aberdeen, you know, is kind of like a haunted hotspot. And it's simply because I don't think they promote it so much in the agenda, whereas Edinburgh is very, very savvy when it comes to trying promoting their tourist industry, and rightly so. They got a fantastic tourist industry, which unfortunately Aberdeen doesn't seem quite able to attract. I think people tend to go outside the city for, you know, castle country and what have you instead. That seems to be the way of it.
Yeah, very well. Well, obviously, I think that's a fair place to start, really, because now, you may tell me off here, my geography might be off slightly, Graham. Isn't Balmoral in Aberdeenshire?
It's further out. It's on the Cairngorms, well, almost in the Cairngorms part. Yeah, past Braemar, that kind of area. Mm. I've never actually been. That sounds really awful. I've been to Braemar, but I've never been to Balmoral Castle. I've seen it from a distance, but it's a great looking building, I have to say, but I'm not much. I've visited these places, but I'm not really collected stories from many of these really outlying places. If you know what I mean, it tends to be more focused on the city. The castle ghosts, you see, they've been written about often enough, and I thought, well, I better not go so tampering with these stories, because that I could add anything to them.
Yeah,
there's a lot of haunted castles in Aberdeenshire, as there is a lot of haunted pubs in Edinburgh, you know, but. How many are real or not? It's kind of debatable.
Yeah, yes. I think a lot of these castle stories, they are very similar, I think. And Balmoral's a little bit special because you've got the connection with John Brown, and supposedly his ghost is one of them that's supposed to wander around. And I think with Scotland, a lot of these castle ghosts are always widowed brides or wronged clansmen from the troubles back in those days.
Yeah.
And so it's much of a muchness, I think. And I prefer the nitty gritty stories. So when you get into places like Aberdeen, it's always reassuring to find that even in such a town like that, that you've got a few haunted pubs where people have had some frightening encounters.
Yes, no, absolutely. The pubs in Aberdeen, there are a few. I've been in a few, I might add, over the years. But the best, I think, for me, the one I found most disturbing, I suppose, was a pub called the Moorings, which is now called Krakatoa, which is like an old coaching inn, and it's down by the harbour. And that used to be the main route out of the city. So you'd come in literally by the coast road and out again and head up to Fraserburn, Peterhead, all these places up north. And there'd been all sorts of rumours about that place being haunted for many years. Typically, the toilet had this strange vibe, according to people. It seems to be another thing that happens in pubs. But anyway, the gentleman who owned the pub's name's Craig, and invited me round to have a wee look and kind of explain some of the things that had been happening. And it all sort of centred around the cellar area mainly. And that is, the cellar itself had been done up a few times. And it seemed like any time there was some kind of work done or things were moved, somebody was grumbling and making themselves be known. They weren't happy with these changes. And according to Craig, they'd set up some recording equipment in the basement, EVP stuff. Now, they put bands on all the time. I mean, that's their main business. So they've got this high-tech equipment. And they were left this thing running all night. And apparently a male voice was heard screaming, "Put the price list back," because there used to be an old pub price list in the basement, and I've seen it. It's all like, 1970s prices. Wish it was then again, but never mind. And the pub sign was moved because we're going to chuck it out, basically. And then this voice was heard grumbling soon after. But I think the scariest story was about a lady called Anne, if I remember correctly, and her, she disappeared anyway from the, she was a regular in the pub and she disappeared. And they were drinking one day in the pub, and Craig was working, and the police came in looking for her, and he said, "Well, you haven't seen her for ages." And then later on, he's down in the basement counting, the takings, because that's where all the office was. And a photograph, this is after closing time, by the way, a tiny wee photograph fluttered down from the rafters above where the ceiling, and landed in front of him. And it was one of those old passport photos from the 70s, you'd get in one of those photo booths, a little tiny black and white photo of the woman who'd been missing. And on the back was written her name. And I think it was dated, if I remember correctly, something like 1972. And of course, he got the shock of his life and he bolted out the door and locked the door and was really nervous to go back in. And apparently the police arrived a few days later and spoke to him and said, "Oh, we found out what happened to your customer, and she died in hospital." And that just is, this was our photograph. What the hell it was doing underneath the floorboard since 1972, then coincidentally dropped in his lap, nobody knows. But he said it was quite terrifying. She was probably letting him know she was about. That was quite frightening, he said.
I can imagine. I mean, even on not a paranormal sense, Graham, that's one of those weird coincidences where, as you say, why did that photo fall out at that particular point during that period of time where she disappeared?
Yeah, it seems odd, doesn't it, to be like that? There was also things like poltergeist activity. People claimed to see, buckets with mops in them being pushed on their own. Smoke would suddenly, a little puff of smoke would appear at the bar. A knife was once pinged off the counter. A figure of the guy, there was an old airman there, a Canadian, who's in his 80s, I believe. He worked away pretty much till the end of his life. He was a cellarman there, and he used to roll, he'd be seen rolling the barrel, as it were, in the cellar, and his figure was actually apparently seen in the process of pushing what would have been a barrel. So it was all sorts of bizarre phenomena. It had a weird heavy vibe, the pub, I have to say. I mean, I'm quite a feel quite sensitive when I go into buildings. If there's a building that's got a strange vibe, I do feel it. I get a bit kind of, ooh, don't like that. But apparently it was built on the site of what was called the Potty, which was a drowning pool just at the edge of what was the original harbour. And people who were found guilty of infanticide or whatever would have their thumbs and toes tied together and chucked in this pool to drown. And it happened to be, according what looks to be anyway, according to old maps, pretty much outside where that current building stands. So there's been a whole very negative kind of history associated with area also. So I don't know if people believe in that, but it potentially could explain some of the phenomena maybe.
I think the one thing I've always been surprised about Aberdeen, and I might have got this completely wrong, Graham, is that they're supposed to be where the bus company offices are.
Yes.
It's supposed to be one of the most haunted buildings in the city. Is that right?
It is. It's strange. It's strange. It's a very old building. It's 1865 or thereabouts. And honestly, I've heard so many stories. I've actually spoken to so many people personally that have had really bizarre experiences. And it was all centred around, allegedly, a Gordon Highlanders captain called Captain Beaton, who hung himself when he'd been sent back from the trenches to recover. Now it was a tram depot, but it was taken over during the war by the army, and it was an army hospital as well, so there were ill people there, and the guy was put back there to recuperate, and they had the army staying in barracks all the way around there, the little wee rooms and such like, and before he was sent back, he apparently hung himself in what was called the South Turret. And when I got invited round a few years to look around, this is before it's been done up. Unfortunately, it's been completely gutted. Back then, there were still remnants of the old building. And in the South Turret, the lady who showed me around shone the torch up. And on the rafters, way up high, in this tiny little sort of fake medieval tower, if you like, was a frayed rope hanging, which they claimed had been there since the time of the hanging. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. But staff had talked about seeing the guy for years. I mean, I had a mate that worked there. He's a bus conductor, and he also worked in the office. He told me he came in late one night, and he used to put their money in the safe and, you know, and head off. And the lights were on a timer, so the light was now clicking on and off. Something had kind of interfered with the light. And he said he looked through the door, and the temperature was icy cold, and he could see a kilt walking up the stairs. So he got the shock of his life. And another guy, same thing, actual Gordon Highlander in full dress, kilt uniforms, walking up the stairs in front of him, and vanished through what became the toilet block, but was the officer's mess back in the day. So there's been lots of reports of that. And when the buildings be done up, workmen would also report things like being pushed on the stairs. And one guy had a brick actually literally pulled out of his hand while he was cementing a wall. And the brick, he said, floated down to the ground. It didn't fall. It's floated. And of course, he was pretty upset about that. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. But what's the bizarre thing is, that no, I mean, the Gordon Highlanders are the local regiment for the area, and I went to the museum, and there's absolutely no record of a Captain Beaton ever being in the Gordon Highlanders. But nevertheless, the stories of a Highlander have persisted since the 1920s. So whether the name is just something that's been tacked on afterwards, I don't know. But certainly the folk I spoke to said, yeah, we saw a Gordon Highlander. I mean, it might not be a Captain Beaton, but it's certainly a somebody. And it's very bizarre. But unfortunately, the building is really modernised now, so it's kind of lost that kind of, you know, authenticity.
Yeah. I think often as well, when we get stories like this, Graham, like with Captain Beaton, I think, as you touch on in when we start talking about a couple of things that happened in Edinburgh, often stories can be told and people miswrite the name down or misspell it.
That's true.
I mean, for all we know, it could have been Beeson or Beaton or whatever, Deaton. It could be anything. But I suppose when you look at the list of who served in that particular regiment, you could there's only so much time you can spend trying to do it. And then I suppose you're thinking, well, did the person misunderstand this name? Is it this name? And that'll probably end up sending you even further away from where it is. So I think it's one of those frustrations, obviously, sometimes where it all depends who told the original story and who wrote it down in the first instance, I suspect.
Well, that's true. And I think as well, what's interesting is that I did speak to someone and they said that, you know, if he did take his own life, it was really frowned upon then, especially a soldier. So the potential is that his name either could be removed from the record or his burial, because there was no evidence of a burial, would have been hush-hush. He'd have probably been buried in a, you know, kind of like almost like an unmarked grave potentially in the within the compound, we don't know. So there is that aspect too. But I mean, Beaton, apart from him, there's been other weird stuff associated with outside the building, because when I first started investigating area, and this is going back a fair few years, like 15 years ago, there was the original tram sheds there that had been used, you know, since the Victorian era. Mm. And a beautiful collection of buildings. I mean, I spoke to a number of security guards, for example, who worked there at night. And at the end of one was this great big door, heavy wooden door, locked with a huge, huge, clunky, great padlock. And it led to what was actually the military hospital wing, which I've been around a few times. I've got loads of photos of it. Very creepy, decrepit place. And, you know, you can imagine. And this guy who's now patrolling at night, walking around in this great big drafty, vaulted tram sheds, heard two men arguing from the furthest end. And, of course, the assumption was somebody had left a radio on, because the radios would often, the people working on the buses would go under, you know, these pits where you lie and you do the repairs, would put the radio on. So he went over to see what it was, but the voices were actually coming from inside the locked hospital. There's actually no other way to get into that building by that door. Mm-hmm. It's no windows or nothing. You know, it's just a literally solid block of stone with everything, all the windows facing into the tram shed. So he bolted. And I mean, a mate of mine worked cleaning buses there. And again, he was cleaning buses in those sheds late at night. You know, he used to clean them every time his shift was over. And he's cleaning on top with a mop and bucket. And suddenly something starts to shake the bus, and he actually fell and the bucket spilled. And he was furious because he assumed it was his mate. His mate was called Andy. And I know both of these guys, I've known them for years. And he was shouting out the window abuse at this guy, Andy, assuming he'd just been pushing the bus for a lark.
Yeah.
And Andy comes walking across from a completely random part of the building, totally unaware of what was going on. So whoever it was, it wasn't a person of flesh and blood, put it that way. that was quite unnerving.
I think it's remarkable as well, because even when it became the bus company's headquarters, did they keep the hospital wing basically untouched for a long time, Grant?
They did, yeah. I used to go around. One of my other bit interests was taking photographs of old buildings, you know, that were getting knocked down.
Yeah.
And Aberdeen's, pretty much all its old buildings have been well and truly done up over the years. There's very few, you know, old undisclosed gems like you would find in bigger cities like Edinburgh or Glasgow. And so I used to pop along there, and they were really nice folk, actually. They used to let me in. just go and help yourself, take some photographs. And, yeah, it was fascinating. It was... you know, it was like two stories, a creepy old attic. It's all full of old, you know, those roll sheets, destination sheets we'd have in front of old buses were all lying stacked up amongst a load of dead pigeons. And, ugh, you know, it was like, it was kind of really grim, but bit interesting.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I used to go around there and take photographs. And I actually, to be fair, never saw anything during the whole time I was in there. I mean, it wasn't that often, but... you can imagine it would be the kind of place something may potentially have happened. I never had the pleasure, unfortunately, but I say the stories were all very good, and I was lucky to actually speak to probably 75% of the people that actually had provided stories for the book in the face to face, and they were all very, very you know, decent, serious people. They had nothing to lose. In fact, somehow positively embarrassed talking about it, you know what I mean? Because they thought I was going to, you know, poke fun at them. But yeah, it's an interesting building. I'd say it's one of the most interesting in the city for sure.
Yeah. I mean, obviously Aberdeen has a long history of fishing, Graham, being one of the key centres in Scotland's industrial revolution for yes, numerous industries. I suppose one of the great aspects of a city like Edinburgh is that you're also going to have some sort of paranormal stories in regards to the whole fishing industry, because often where you've got a well-established harbour with a long history, you'll often get strange tales of the sea as well, won't you?
Well, Leith's an odd one. You know, like, Leith is one of the areas that I didn't actually cover too much in my book. And the reason being is that a friend of mine, John, has written a number of books in Leith, and that's kind of his area of expertise. And he lives not too far from it, and he studied that for many years. And he had friends who were and family who've lived there for years. And he really is a huge font of knowledge in the area. And because he'd already touched in many of his stories, I didn't want to kind of poach them too much.
Yes.
But yeah, there is that tradition, and there's also the tradition of the not some also this you know not just the seafaring aspect, but the whole industry surrounding it on shore with the bonded warehouses and all that kind of thing. And there's quite a number of buildings allegedly haunted in that area that were once upon a time involved in the industry. Some very creepy ones as well, you know, like obviously the sailors, of course, being popular figures to be seen. But also strangely, things like, I remember reading once about a cavalier being seen, which was an odd one. And that was farther along from Leith, now just along from there. I can't remember the area. It's Wardy, I think it was called Wardy. And a cavalier had been seen there. Now, that is the shorefront also, but further along. But why a cavalier? Nobody could really work out. But it's pretty random. But, yeah, there's supposed to be a figure seen there. Always staring up at this hotel, which I believe no longer exists. But that's what he was seen doing. Leith's an interesting place, though. It's... I mean, it's got obviously not just the local industries, but it's also got further up you go towards the main part of Emery, you've got the theatres, etc. And again, they kind of have their own ghost stories. Mm. They are pretty much all over the city. It's not just, I think people think just because the Royal Mile is the most publicised area, but there's an awful lot of stuff in the peripherals as well.
Yeah. I think often as well, when you have a city like Edinburgh, Graham, people will tend to focus on the sort of more notorious ones or the ones that are internationally famous. And I think it's easy to kind of focus on the big ones without looking at some of the other ones, which is often where the best stories often lie, I think, Graham, because I think if you've heard, and I mean, we'll touch on them anyway, a couple of them, but I think there's only so many times you can discuss the Mackenzie, the Poltergeist and Great Friars Graveyard and the stories of that without sort of, you suddenly realise you've probably read everything, I think, or heard everything. Whereas when you've got other places, I mean, one of my favourite places that I've seen a couple of shows about and a couple of mini documentaries about and read about is the Banshee Labyrinth.
Oh my God, yeah. It's a great...
As a former licensee, Graham, having had a couple of strange experiences in locals that I ran over the years.
Yes.
Nothing too sort of, you know, fully formed, but just weird things that happened that made you scratch your head and think, that's a bit odd. There's nothing like being working in a cellar where a barrel rolls down an incline really slowly, whereas normally it would fly down.
That would be terrifying.
I was just mucking about doing some line cleaning, and I just heard this little ting, and I turned around and a great big barrel had rolled down the incline and just rested gently against the wall, whereas normally, let that go, it would fly down, smash. Yeah. So whoever was helping me out that day, I was very grateful.
Yeah, but it probably made you a bit nervous to go back down again later on. That's the only problem.
Well, that was the thing. It was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Oh, God. Okay, right.
It was one of those places. It was just generally creepy, whatever time of day you were around there, Graham. It just didn't matter. But the darker it got, the stranger it got. I'll say that.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But yeah, the Banshees is one of those wonderful places as well, because it's like a little catacomb, isn't it? It's a bar.
Yeah.
It's got so many parts to it, hasn't it?
It has. It's quite interesting. It's got like I went there years ago and I never really had a proper look around. And it was only like, literally when I was researching the book, I thought, well, I better get myself down and have a proper look around. And it's interesting. You go in the front door, there's a kind of bar, that little bar, it's cute. And then you go down and sit stairs, there's more seating through into what was a kind of vault or the remaining part of a very low vault. So you've got this kind of barrel vault ceiling and a seating there. And then suddenly you find yourself in another. So it is a labyrinth. There's more and more rooms dotted around the place. They're all different levels, which kind of adds to the fun. And you've got an underground haunted cinema that's actually built into the vault itself, which is South Bridge, it's called. And they've got a little 40-seater cinema in there, and you can go in and have a pint in an allegedly haunted cinema, which is brilliant.
Yeah.
And it's, each pretty much everywhere in there's a story. And I mean, you know, there's that famous story of the Watcher. Of course, that's one of, you know, anybody sort of has looked at Edinburgh's ghosts will always have read about the Watcher, but because it's not just the Banshee, it seems to be the pubs and the vaults in those streets where this similarly described figure hangs out. But yeah, he's one of them. But there's also, you know, the ghost of a girl there called Molly. There's, oh, I don't know, there's been a guy seen that looks like he's on fire. This dark, shadowy male figure as well that's neither of those. And a ghost that haunts the toilet called the Old Jock, which is a cliched Scottish name for sure, but never mind.
Yeah.
And it's really strange, but I don't think this will be in the book. No, it definitely won't be. But I'll tell you this is true. Because I often say to folk, you should go to the Banshee Lab, because I genuinely do believe it is a haunted pub. Mm. And unlike many others, there's lots of stuff been happening. So I met a couple from Preston on my tour a few weeks ago, and I said to them, oh, actually, it was a couple of months ago, to be truthful. And I said to them, why don't you go to the Banshee Labyrinth for a drink? It's a great bar. And they were like, well, we might do. And so the next day, I'm waiting at the starting point to do a history tour, and along comes the couple, and the lady comes over and said to me, and I quote, why didn't you tell me the toilet was haunted? And I said, well, I actually forgot, because that building has so many ghosts. I mean, I could be standing there for an hour chatting about them. So I forgot. And she said, well, I was in washing my hands last night, and something came in behind me and grabbed my bag off my shoulder and wrenched it off. And she said to me, this is true, she said, you're probably going to say, well, so what? A bag can fall off a shoulder. She says, well, look at my wrists and my hands. She's got really bad arthritis. She couldn't properly make fists. She said, my husband has to pin my bag onto my lapel of my jacket using a great big kind of safety pin. And whatever it was, unclipped that and pulled the bag off literally within about 2 seconds flat. So she was out there like a rocket. That's what she said to me. And she said, she looked pretty nervous. She didn't go back then, you know, to visit again that evening, put it that way. And that's true. That happened literally a few months ago. So, you know, people shouldn't listen to my recommendations, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Is it only the ladies that are haunted?
Apparently so. Apparently good. Old Jocks just haunts the ladies, Lou. The men are fine. They're all right. You know?
Well, that's all right then. I'll definitely visit.
Well, there you go. It's a win-win.
Yeah, I've got a friend of mine who's deeply interested in the paranormal, especially in haunted toilets, Graham. So I'll have to ask him if he's ever made it to Edinburgh and visited the Banshee haunted toilet, hopefully with permission to wander into the ladies.
Well, yeah. But you can get in early. I mean, we were lucky. We got in before it was open, you see, so we could just wander about at will. And what was interesting was my wife's phone kept pinging the whole time, you know, as if messages were being sent. I think it was something like 37 pings in about a minute, but not one single message came through. And as we sat at the bar, away from the bar, there was very, very distinct shuffling behind the bar and a great big clumping thump from round the corner. And of course, I got up to see it, but there was nobody there. And then suddenly her colleague arrived. But up to that point, it was just the three of us, myself, my wife, Carol, and SJ, who's the manageress, and that was it. But there was noises coming from all over the shop. It was unusual. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not stopped me going back, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, it's a good pub, but I think it definitely has a very distinct vibe about it for sure.
Mm. Is it that kind of situation, Graham? That obviously, I live in Sheffield, and we've got a couple of pubs that promote themselves like that. Do you think it's often one of those situations where a lot of places go, oh, this place is haunted, primarily because it's just an old building?
Yeah, I do think that people who promote their buildings as being haunted will have that at the back of their mind, I'm sure, and it's got the look. And people who come in to see it probably, I don't mean to sound awful, but maybe not so discerning, and because it's old, and somebody's told them it's haunted, they kind of just, you know, it all just sort of keeps building itself up. Mm. I think what's different about the Banshee is, as opposed to, like, most of our pubs have quite sort of vague descriptions, you know, shadowy figures being seen, or allegedly, they always use the word allegedly, the ghost of a girl, or whispering, or something. But these were very, very distinct witnessed phenomena. For example, SJ was sitting in the main office upstairs, and we got to look in it, and it's got a screen with all the CCTVs in the one room, so you can see all the different rooms throughout the building. So yeah. You can see everything that's going on. And she said to me that she was sitting, and she's skeptical, by the way. She was sitting there one evening watching, just having her cup of tea, watching what's going on. And her, the door at the office is locked. Now, suddenly something's pushing the door to get in, and there's this horrible sort of rasping breath behind the door that's really quite, you know, very pronounced. Mm. And she's terrified, and she's watching this on the screen. And, of course, outside the door where the camera's placed is showing absolutely nothing. And, I mean, that's coming from somebody who said, even despite that, she was still questioning whether it was a phenomenon or she'd had some kind of, you know, hallucination almost. But that was a really strange one. And people like our colleagues who've witnessed, I mean, one guy apparently missed his bus, and so you were allowed to sleep over if you wanted in one of the spare rooms. It's called the Mary Queen of Scots room. It only opens for bands, I believe, at the weekend or whatever.
Yeah.
And the guy's sleeping there, and he woke up to find a guy leaning over him in the dark, and he, of course, he screamed and jumped up and went right through the guy, and the guy vanished. And that guy also was very skeptical. In fact, he'd been openly mocking the whole idea of ghosts literally before that, saying it was a load of old rubbish and blah blah blah, you know, that kind of thing. And yeah, I reckon he got a wee bit of a wake-up call that maybe. But they're quite good solid stories, which I think makes it quite appealing to me.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting as well, as you say about SJ there. Sometimes people will try and explain away something that is just so peculiar.
Mm.
That you think, well, you know, in all the people that we've met, in all our walks of life, Graham, whatever we've done, wherever we've been,
mm.
I mean, how many people can we honestly say have said, oh, yeah, I've hallucinated something?
Yeah, very few.
So I always find it seems to be one of those, when we come to the paranormal, often people will grasp at any kind of medical condition we can explain things with, mm. and say, oh, well, that's happened to them.
Mm.
And you're like, well, is it happening to everybody that's claiming to have had an experience then? Because if so, we've got a serious medical issue going on,
yeah,
all over the place, haven't we?
No, absolutely. I mean, what is it? Supposedly, that's something like 1 in 3 people in the UK have had a paranormal experience. Well, that suggests that a third of the population are suffering under some kind of malady.
Yes.
You know, I'm skeptical. Or cynical, or whatever you would call it, when it comes to certain... I mean, I've been given stories before, but I found it quite obviously it's not true. And sometimes it's mainly because people misconstrue a situation. It's not because they're trying to con you or fool you or lead you into something, but it's just they misconstrue a situation. But I just don't get how people are you know, not just scientists, because you do get very scientifically minded people who also have beliefs. I mean, I spoke to a parapsychologist actually at the Edinburgh Uni, and she said the same, that there are people that have that, you know, belief system and obviously, you know, want scientific evidence, which is interesting because it tends to be either one or the other.
Mm.
I'm not sort of into blind faith either, but I do think that there is stuff out there that we don't know, but the problem is skeptics are always trying to explain it away, like there is a rational reason for this. Maybe we're not meant to know everything. Maybe there's a bit of mystery about life. Maybe that's a good thing, mm. I think, anyway. You know, it's for me. But I don't know. That's just my opinion.
No, I think it is. I think often, as with anything, any situation or any discipline can often lead to dogmatic theories regardless, Graham, and I think just because you find yourselves in the scientific community does not mean you won't fall into that preconceived bias regardless. And it's the same with the paranormal, like you say. It's good to have a foot in both camps, which I try to do, because often, like you say, I've read and seen things in regards to the paranormal and just found it, you know, just full of cliches and nonsense. And I'm sure anybody that's listened to this show will know I'm not a big fan of most modern paranormal investigations, though I have to say that the recent series about Ghosts in Scotland, Spook Scotland, that was on recently was quite refreshing, if slightly amusing. I didn't expect a swearing ghost to be hanging around in a basement in one of the particular episodes, but that made me chuckle.
I've never seen that.
So, I would recommend it. It was good fun, actually, with Evelyn Hollow and Gail Porter. So it was nice to go and see a few, once again, a couple of locations I wasn't aware of. outside of the normal ones. So that was good fun. But I suppose when you've got a city as old as Edinburgh, you're going to have several pubs and hotels that have that do really have some kind of haunted one. But would you say the Banshee's probably the best one?
Yeah, I would say so, definitely. I mean, the Mitre, which, again, I've been in a few times, supposedly as a ghost interferes with the jukebox. But these are very, very sporadic things that, you know, I've only heard a couple of reports. The Banshee seems to be a lot. You know, there's an awful lot of stuff. I mean, it's obviously built in a very old area as well. And there's all sorts of theories as to who and why is haunting it. It's an odd one. I mean, I remember Esd again told me about the story that, according to her, anyway, the what happened was, I think when the pub was getting done up not that long ago, the couple that had owned it were in painting with our young daughter, who I think was about 3 or 4 at the time. Just to get things speeded along a bit, I guess. And the wee girl kept tugging at dad's arm and pointing to the door, saying, "Who's the man on fire? And who's the fire ghost?" And the guy was obviously getting nervous, and he says, What you mean?" He says, "The man over there, the man on fire." And that was quite intriguing. So they put their, you know, brushes down and vacated the premises rather quickly. And of course, people have then said, "Well, wait a minute, the Great Fire of Edinburgh was destroyed that area." And so that seemed to kind of fit nicely. But then a historian has come in and said, "Well, wait a minute, the Great Fire only destroyed like a certain row of houses, not quite that bit, so could it be connected, isn't it?" We don't know, but it was an odd thing for a kid to say. But then kids have got that ability, haven't they, that adults tend to lose. They seem to be the ones that are more open to stuff. And yeah, well, anyway, the parents left. They must have believed her. But that's terrifying. I actually think if I'd heard that, I would have probably been pretty scared myself, I have to say.
It takes
quite a bit to scare me, you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. Put the decorating off for another day, Graham.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
So, one of the other stories from Edinburgh that I think often gets overlooked is the infamous, well, it depends how well you know the story, the infamous Mummy's Curse, Graham, which is one that obviously, I think a lot of people don't realise just how mad everybody in Britain went about Egyptology 100 years ago. It was absolutely everywhere. It was, every major newspaper was covering it. There was books everywhere. There seemed to be tourists flocking there. It was a real explosion of interest in it. And it seems that out of this period, obviously the most famous curse is what happened to Howard Carter and the like, allegedly, once their discovery of Tutankhamun. But we also seem to have a very similar set of circumstances occurring at one particular property at that point as well, don't we?
That's correct, yes. That's actually coincidentally just round the corner from where we're sitting at this precise moment.
Oh.
The next street up from where we live, the gardens, Lambeth Gardens. And strangely enough, the 1930s, there was Lord Seaton who lived there with his wife, Shozela, and they were, you know, quite a young and well-to-do people, as you can imagine, and travel and Egyptology was fashionable. And they decided to go over there. And according to the story, anyway, he wrote a book about this, but it was also lots of newspaper articles at the time. He went there to Luxor, and his wife was given the opportunity and him to visit this tomb that had just been opened that nobody else had been in. And it was a pre-mummy tomb. So the body was basically just sat on top of a slab and not wrapped, and it had been disintegrated badly. And they went and looked at it, and fascinated. He went out for a cigarette, apparently. His wife said, "Well, I'll go back and have a little peek." And she disappeared. And then afterwards, they said, well, the guy who showed them round, who was local, his name was Abdul, he says, "Well, would you like to go to, you know, the souvenir shop where all the tourists would get their souvenirs?" Which are probably real artifacts then, but never mind. Yeah. And they went across, and she said, "No, I'm okay." And so that was a bit unusual. And then when they returned to Edinburgh, she suddenly presents her husband with a glass box and in it a little bone. And this was the backbone of the mummy, or the pre-mummy corpse, which he nicked while he was in the tomb. And described as a digestive, heart-shaped digestive. That's what it was, a heart-shaped digestive. And so it was put in the front room. Now, he wasn't very happy about this. But anyway, it was a talking point. And soon after, strange phenomena used to happen, including, you know, things falling off walls, like a big chimney stack nearly fell down and nearly killed someone at a party. Just missed them. Mm. But then things like crashing would be heard in the morning, and they'd go into the rooms, and the whole room would be absolutely trashed, all the furniture upended. And some mornings, they'd hear the noise, the trashing going in, and find that everything was as was, but the noise of, you know, violent disorder had taken place. And then his nephew came, and he saw a guy walking up the stairs wearing what was described as Egyptian robes, and as did the maid, and it went on and on. But what was really bizarre was it was given to Howard Carter, who said he believed it to be cursed, and it was passed to a number of journalists. And of course, they were writing articles, and he was making money from this, but he was sort of like biting the hand that feeds, because one minute he was complaining about, you know, people taking the mickey out of the guy, but also were paying at the same time. It was one of these situations. But anyhow, he ended up burning the bone. Well, his uncle did, who was a monk, came from a local abbey and burnt the bone in the backyard. And his wife, of course, was furious about this, but partly the phenomenon never stopped. People were ill. I think they divorced eventually. But what was even scarier was the guys they gave the bone to, the reporters. One of them died, I believe, and the other one also had a very serious accent, which again seemed an awful coincidence. Yeah, it's an interesting story. But there's been a sort of couple of sightings recently, which makes it even more scary, because, I mean, this was obviously 1933 or whatever. But quite recently, a guy was round there working who was he was a Reiki master, that's correct. He was doing Reiki healing for one of his clients who lived there. And she had felt a bit queasy after the Reiki session and said, "Look, can you stop? I'm going to go and get water," and left the room. And when she came back, the guy was in absolute bits, because while she'd been gone, this tall figure was now seen right behind the door, and he was so terrified of it. He was wearing what he thought was a veil or some kind of robe, and he couldn't tell if it was a man or a woman. And anyway, this guy was interviewed recently, and he looked absolutely genuinely terrified. He looked like thinking about it was causing some kind of trauma. And he agreed that if he was ever going to see the client again, it wouldn't be at that building. and that was not that long ago. That was literally 5 or 6 years ago or whenever. So, yeah, it's something strange about that building, I'm convinced.
I think it's very interesting as well, because the thing about all this is that Seton actually gave interviews, didn't he, about it? So he was clearly convinced something odd was happening, because I find it very hard to believe that a man of his means would sell a story to the press, Graham, on the hope of making a few pounds.
Yeah, he did have there was money there for sure. So yeah, I think from what I've read, I've never read the whole book, but I've certainly read the chapter about that particular visit. He did genuinely seem like disturbed about the whole thing and perplexed, and I think it did plague in his mind. It really did. I think he regretted in some ways telling his story, because he felt the public in some instances weren't behind him. I think they thought he was doing it as a joke almost. But I do think he was deadly serious, and obviously it caused real problems for the family, and I guess the marriage and such like suffered because of it. His wife, during all this time, I mean, she did witness things herself, but seems to be the one out of both of them seemed to be almost in denial of it.
Yeah.
You know, and was like angry when he got rid of the bone. And I mean, I guess the simplest thing, well, probably the best solution would have gone right back there and put it back in its rightful place. But obviously that was never done.
I'm going to say, because often you'll hear this about certain things. Obviously, there are a few of these stories from that particular period of time from around the UK where people stole something, Graham, and slipped it in a handbag or their trouser pocket or something and ended up wanting it sent back. And we still get these stories occasionally where people will take artifacts or pebbles or stones from certain locations or bits of walls that will chip off and stuff, and then 6 months later, something will come through the post to this particular location saying, "I'm sorry I took this. My life's been hell ever since. Have it back."
No, totally. It's a weird one. I had a family from Australia on one of my tours, and they were telling me a story about somebody they knew who'd gone to a sacred site and they'd stolen a stone. You know, it was an Aboriginal site, and you weren't meant to touch a thing. Mm. And they picked up literally an interesting little shaped stone and took it back. And according to them, when it went back to their house, which is outside of Australia, this phenomena started to happen, poltergeist phenomena out of the blue, and it was literally at the time the stone was taken. So, you know, you got to think it must be something connected, surely. And that was a sacred site. So that was one. A tourist actually told me that one while they were on one of my tours, which is quite interesting. So it seems like a universal problem, you know, people are shouldn't really be touching things they shouldn't be touching, basically. So I'm careful when I'm about never to pick anything up, you know, it's too, especially in a place like that. Obviously, never contemplate that, but yeah, it's an odd one.
Very true. I mean, obviously, one of my favourites from Edinburgh is exactly the kind of opposite thing you would expect, because for anybody that's a lover of libraries and books in general, you go to the library for a bit of peace and quiet and calm, Graham.
Yes.
And yet in your book, you've got this incredible story. It's a first-hand one from the witness.
Yes.
I mean, this is the other thing about the book. There are so many first-hand reports that you've got in this book in regards to Edinburgh that I think that's what elevates it, because often, as we were joking earlier, before we started the conversation proper, there are so many books written about ghosts in certain parts of the world, it's very easy to just tidy them up a bit and change it around and just say, right, here's some old stories. But the thing about your most recent book is that you've got, primarily, I think, because of your love of this subject and also the fact that you do the ghost tours, Graham, that you will get an opportunity to speak to people and get first-hand, up-to-date additions to these well-versed traditional stories.
Yes, yes. I'm in a lucky position. I think it was 2 weeks ago, we've got a WhatsApp group, and there was a photograph came through of a guy who'd been on one of the ghost tours who'd actually been scratched on the back, you know, I'd say the Mackenzie thing, which, you know, I know, like I say, it's well talked about, well-versed stories, but that kind of stuff does happen a lot. And it's odd because it's like a story like that, unlike, you know, the library story is so dyed in the wool that you get blasé about it. You think, well, so what? Somebody got scratched in the back. But I guess if that story was standing there in isolation, that might be quite a shocking thing. But it's odd. I kind of more drawn to the more obscure ones and the ones that are kind of fresh and not being written about, because I think, well, there's potential for more there, and that's why I find fascinating. Because the things like the Mackenzie could probably go on and on forevermore, and unless they actually discover something that actually is, who is the ghost or whatever, that might be quite interesting. But the whole phenomena of the scratching, biting, it's been going on for years. It's like we're all getting a bit blasé about it, I think. Which is shocking, but you know, that if that story was in isolation, it would be like, wow, it would be incredible. But,
absolutely. I mean, often that's when you hear certain poltergeist cases. I mean, the famous one from the States with the Sally House, as it was called, and that was notable because the guy just kept getting scratched all the time. So, like you say, I must have seen hundreds of reports of people saying they've been scratched and bit and nipped and grabbed.
Yes,
with Mackenzie lurking somewhere allegedly around them, Graham. But the thing about the library one is, not only is this a report from a kind of person you wouldn't expect, because I think when we hear stories from security guards or cleaners or people who work in the emergency services, that it gives it a little bit more credence, because at the end of the day, a lot of these people spend a lot of time on their own in locations which a normal person may think is creepy, but for them it's just their normal job. And yet this guy goes through something which, in the annals of modern paranormal stories, is one of the most violent incidents I can remember.
Yes. Yes, it's terrifying, actually. I mean, I think, out of pretty much all the stories, if I was involved, what he was had been involved with, I would have, you know, that would have been very chastening, shall we say. But anyway, he ended up, he was a night watchman, and he was called in at the last minute to patrol the library because the guy whose shift it was off ill. Now, he worked in a completely different part of the city. I can't remember which building it was, but it certainly wasn't the library. And he got asked to go in. And the first time he'd done it, so he just was following protocol, and that is to go around the building. And I think there are something like little timing strips, I don't know how it works, where you kind of have to go in certain areas at a certain time, and it's counted. So then your boss knows you've basically gone around the whole area as opposed to sitting, you know, slurping tea somewhere in a corner.
Yeah.
The poor guy had to patrol this building, and he went downstairs, and it's a massive building. I mean, it's enormous, and it's got so many stories and basements. God only knows. I've only ever seen a tiny part of it. And he decides upon himself to go right down to the bottom, I think it was. First floor, they described it as. Yeah, the first floor, that's what it's described as, at least. Which is below ground, if you like, below the bridge. Mm. And he's wandering about there. And he came into this room, and it had a... Well, he said it was like an old-fashioned door, and he went to investigate the door. Now, in this room was nothing, literally, but I think an old viewfinder and a broom, if I remember correctly, and some broken down photocopier. But anyway, the door slammed behind him, and the lights went off. And then suddenly he gets punched in the stomach, which he said was very forceful, which actually sent him on his back, which must be terrifying. And then something cracked him over the head, which turns out to have been the broom, and it actually broke over the guy's head. And he said, according to his report, was climbing, once he got out, because he said, for the first time since primary school, I actually prayed to God, and the lights were on, he got out the door, because he couldn't get the door open. And so he's now crawling up the staircase, and he said he had to run the toilet, and he was vomiting. He says he was at an absolute shock, and phoned up his boss, and his boss came in, and got him calmed down. And, the typical gist of the story was that he said, what were you doing down there? He says, the guy who, you know, comes and does this job normally won't go near it because apparently it's haunted, which would be helpful knowing in advance.
Yeah, thanks for that, mate.
Yeah, cheers, you know. But the guy said he would never go back. He's never been back in the building. He said it's probably one of the scariest experiences of life, but he was actually physically sick at the end of it. And it was... according to the people who patrol regularly, there are certain areas they don't go into. But strangely enough, when I spoke to the staff, they seemed unaware of the ghost. But of course, they've all got their own sections. They're not exactly rooting about in the middle of the night in these obscure rooms when everybody's gone home. So there is that to be taken into account. And it's one hell of a big building, I have to say. I would not be pleased having to walk around a building that huge at night. It's very daunting, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's what I am to the guy. And like I said at the beginning, he says, you believe this or not? He says, but this is exactly how it is. And he just told me as it was. So I've got no reason to doubt him, because he got no benefit from telling me, put it that way. So he seemed quite happy to tell the story.
Yeah. Do you often, when you're doing your tours, Graham, I suppose it often helps when people understand what you're doing and your love of this particular subject. Do you often get that situation where at the end of it, when everybody's sort of disappearing off, somebody will be hanging around wanting to share an experience that may have happened to them in Edinburgh or something? So I know in the book you've mentioned a couple of strange occurrences where certain people have, one would say, try to perform to the tour,
yes,
shall we say, because often there will be certain individuals who will book a ghost tour to try and make it more about them than the actual person that's supposed to be leading it.
Yeah, there are a few people that will that have stayed back. I mean, when I often ask at the beginning if anybody believes in ghosts, I mean, I guarantee, and generally speaking, out of tours, one or two people at 20, maybe. It seems a lot less than the 1 in 3 that we discussed earlier. But then people often come back at the end, or when I'm walking ahead, will come up and say, well, you know, I didn't really say, but, because I feel a little kind of embarrassed about it. And we get some interesting stories. And I've actually tried to encourage people to send them to me. And the problem is, somebody will tell me a great story on the tour, and I'll say, look, here's my email, send it to me. Because my idea was to create a book all about stories that people have told me on a ghost tour. So it's not just from Scotland or Emirates, from everywhere, just things they've experienced. I get some great stories, but hardly anybody ever does it. They'll tell you on the night, because you can't really take it all in while you're trying to, you know, deliver your tour and communicate with other people and things. So it's really frustrating. But we do get the odd person, and I think they're quite relieved to tell you. It's an odd one. But some people have said, well, I've never really told anybody, or they'll go, well, my wife will back me up, and then somebody will back up the story. And sometimes it's a family member, and it'll be one of these stories that's, you know, quite moving and quite sad. Somebody they really miss, like a, you know, grandmother or a mum or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's nice. But others are, you know, well, we moved into a house and this happened, something a bit random and scarier. And yeah, you get a handful of still people like that. Not too often, I'm afraid. But I mean, 2 weeks ago, a guy said to me that he thought he'd seen a figure in one of the open mausoleums in Greyfriars. And it was a man with a white shirt who just happened to be sort of, he said he was leaning, he was sort of curled on the floor, but with his knees under his chin, sitting and facing what would have been the back wall.
Mm.
And he said he was definitely sure he saw him. And he told his wife, and his wife assured me that he would never lie about these things, because, I mean, he wasn't like the kind of guy who believes in that anyway. And he said, did I mind if we went back and had a look? So I said, yeah, sure. So we went back and had a look. And, of course, there's nothing there. But he said for that, when we walked in, he said, "That's I'm absolutely convinced that what that was. That's what he saw." That's what he said.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they're always usually the really good ones, aren't they? Because like you say, it's always better to get a story from somebody who doesn't either believe in the paranormal or is very sceptical or is very matter of fact. Mm. And when they experience something a bit odd, I think that gives it a bit more credence as well, Graham.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's funny. So sometimes when you do a tour, I would, I might ask somebody, you know, do you believe in ghosts or have an interest in the paranormal? There's not one single person will say yes, and then you think, oh my God, I'm doomed. That's like a really hard tour, you know, because one, you're thinking, why the hell are you here? And two, I always say it's like going on a wine tasting tour, but being a teetotaler, you know what I mean? It's kind of, it's a hard sell. And say, oh my God, you've got this kind of hour and a half of these disinterested people who are just kind of filling in an hour and a half, and it's like, God almighty, you know?
Yeah.
That's probably one of the toughest gigs ever.
I think when you look at Edinburgh from the outside, because I know a bit about the history of Edinburgh, I mean, it has a very dark past, Graham. And yet when you look at a lot of the hauntings in and around the city, most of them are quite standard, aren't they? Because obviously, I think anybody that knows anything about Edinburgh's past will know about some of the horrific things that went on during King James I's reign.
Yes.
and the persecution of the witches and people alleged to be witches. I think we know more often than not it was more about where they lived and what land they owned more than anything else, or
indeed, yes,
whether they'd rebuffed a certain young man of a certain clan. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you can't go much further than the horrific stories regarding Burke and Hare and mm-hmm. the strange thing about those dolls that were part of all that story.
That's
which
right.
is a yeah, strange cool. thing. And without wishing to dwell on his particular history too much, the whole story about Major Thomas Weir, which was something, as I said to you earlier, Graham, I was not aware of until about 6 months ago, which is one of the strangest and probably most distasteful stories I've ever come across.
Yeah, it's horrendous. It's absolutely grim.
And when you look at these things, you just think, oh, because I think often when we look at a place's history, some places don't have anything like this. And I think when you've got certain aspects of it that are mm-hmm. so dark and so brutal, mm. on top of everything else about Edinburgh and the problems that you had with poverty and the population in the old days as well,
mm-hmm.
it's remarkable when you look at the vast majority of the hauntings. They all seem fairly innocuous more than anything else. It's just spirits mumbling around more than anything.
Yeah, there's not, you know, I think it's interesting. It's more about the how people react to what they're seeing is the scary bit, because, you know, some people they seem quite kind of placid about the whole event. You'll see a ghost do something, they don't get too wound up about it. But other people get quite hysterical. And I think from witnesses who are hysterical makes the actual ghost story or the ghost sighting itself seem a lot more dramatic than it really is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like you said, it's a good point that actually, because it is true, the 99.9% of sightings tend to be just something that's just there. I do believe that potentially a ghost itself would be a recording from the past that's maybe just doing a thing. It could be walking through a wall, opening a door, or doing something it always did for whatever reason as a recording stuck in that area.
Yeah.
Whereas a spirit that might, you know, be interactive, like a soul, is a much less common thing, and they're sort of more interesting in a way, because there's an element of interaction. And of course, if it's the personality of the spirit, good or bad, would also help shape the form of the visitation. So, you know, like obviously a not a nice person might cause, might manifest itself in an unpleasant experience. It is interesting. I mean, for example, there was we were talking earlier about witchcraft. Obviously, yeah, there's a horrible history when it comes to witchcraft and all these innocent people burned at the stake at the castle. And lots of sightings of supposed witches, or at least the innocent people that died at the stake. And I think the creepiest one is the one about Agnes Sampson, who was one of the witches, I think the Berwick witch trials, who was held down at Holyrood, or Canongate at least. So her spirit apparently has been seen in the palace, and there's a couple of good reports that are quite solid ones that are quite terrifying. And one involved a guy who was there to do he was an electrician. I think he was putting in a plug or something, in the wall of one of these corridors. And he heard a sort of shuffling, and he looked down the corridor, and this figure of a woman who had a shaved head and was wearing what looked like a kind of like a shroud was shuffling towards him, moaning, and of course terrifying. He screamed and bolted. And Agnes is known as Bald Agnes because they shaved her head as part of the torture process. But she's also been seen. She was also seen allegedly, and I think it's about 20 years ago. There was a meeting of a Commonwealth meeting of some description, and I remember they were using part of the building as offices, and the German delegate was there with his secretary, who was a guy, young German guy, and he had gone into this room, this office, which is where the meetings were, the private rooms, if you like, after the meeting. And according to witnesses, he'd gone into the room and they heard him scream, and then he kind of fell back out the way, scattering papers all over the place, and was an absolute nervous wreck. And they got him calmed down, and he claimed when he walked in the room, there was a figure of a woman floating above the desk who had no hair. Oof. Which is absolutely terrifying. that's odd, because that's not just, I don't think, somebody, you know, not just a recording from the past, if you like. That seems like somebody was there for whatever reason, or hanging around there for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And floating as well, which is, that's a very cliched for a ghost to do, but yeah. Certainly would have made it an unforgettable experience. It's an odd one.
Yeah,
I think I would have been very disturbed by that.
was Agnes the one? I mean, was she the lady that was held down in the surf, Graham?
No, that one. Oh, blimey! Now let me think. That was in Solway Firth. Ah, damn! Her name escapes me. Yeah, she was a Covenanter who was drowned in Solway Firth.
Yeah, I mean, that just sounds horrific.
She was 18, yeah, that's right.
Oh, I mean, some of the... When you look at these historical documents, I remember speaking to somebody about the ways they got around the term torture, where, you know, they'd make people walk for 24 hours, because walking's not torture.
Mm.
But it is if you do it for 24 hours.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's horrific when we look back, and I think the more knowledge we look back in and the balance that we bring to these, that the more of these innocent parties we can sort of pull back to redemption, because I think they've been left tarnished with this nonsense about them, Graham, for far too long. I think
Scotland's unfortunately a very superstitious country, and the king, I mean he's a man of his times, but nevertheless what he was writing was ludicrous, and people, a very superstitious country, of course, and resulted in so many deaths. I think Scotland had the worst reputation in Northern Europe, which is nothing to be proud of.
No.
But executions. And I mean, God, you touched on yourself a wee while back when you could literally, if somebody annoyed you, you didn't like what they were at, or they rebuffed you or whatever, all you had to do is point one finger and say, well, I saw them do this. I saw them singing to themselves, you know. Or my cow's got sour milk this morning. It was that old woman next door that I can't stand the sight of. And
people would just go, okay.
Lunacy. What I thought was ridiculous about King James is writing that witches cause storms in Scotland, and you know, we've just got terrible weather. It's got nothing to do with witchcraft, you know. But public got into that whole idea.
It's remarkable, right? Yeah, I think if you ask anybody from Scotland, Graham, they'll tell you. It's especially if you live on the coast. More often than not, you're going to see a storm or two.
Oh, you are, yeah, for sure. It's lunacy, but that was a sign of times. But it's just unfortunate. I think it's quite sad, you know, in a way as well, because we kind of talk about people now, and it's all very kind of, you know, it's a matter of fact, because it's a fact, this happened, that happened, but it's kind of awful when you really think how it must have felt for those people. That's must have been absolutely terrifying. So, but, you know, that's history. It's gone. Nothing can be done. I mean, I guess people should at least learn by mistakes, if nothing else.
Very much so. Very much so. And I think, I think sometimes when people look at these subjects, they do it with, there's some kind of relish and glee about these awful events. And I think, like you say, people need to take a step back and imagine the fear and the persecution that was going on. Because it was like, you know, as we've said, you could just look at somebody funny and the next thing you know, somebody's knocking on your door saying, right.
Yeah.
You're cavorting with Satan. Off you go.
I try and avoid a lot of stories on my tours. Well, you know, I touch on the history, obviously.
Yeah.
But I don't try and go too deeply into, you know, the whole witchcraft thing. Because, I mean, I know some guides have done in the past and they describe tortures and that. And I just find that too grim. And I find, you know, some people might find ghost stories grim, but to me, they're just an absolute treat compared to what humans have done to each other.
Absolutely.
So I try to avoid that because I don't want people leaving thinking they've gone through trauma on the tour. You know, I want them to be interested but curious to go off and explore themselves or whatever. But, I don't want to make people ill. That's not the point of it.
I think... Before I let you go, Graham, I want to talk about one of your personal experiences that happened in Edinburgh. Now, this was several years ago. You were very fortunate enough to be stopping at a wonderful place called The Witchery, which is a fabulous, fabulous location. Mm-hmm. Were you an open-minded person before this happened, Graham? Because when you read your experience, I'm not surprised you do what you do when this happens.
I have to be truthful. I was actually, I'd had a much earlier experience, which was quite profound many years ago. And so it was, I did believe, but that was an interesting one because it was totally unexpected. I mean, it was actually the night after our wedding. We got married at the castle and decided to stay at the Witchery, and we'd kind of put the wedding together by, you know, with a sort of humanist minister came along there with the night there, and we had a meal at another place. It was all just put together, kind of what we wanted. And on the second day, we were actually leaving in the morning, and the guy, his name was Roxy, he'd signed us in, he came across, and I remember correctly, he'd said that your friends had, they'd given us a second night as a gift, as a present, a wedding gift. And it was a surprise, and it was a great surprise, and we were absolutely delighted, of course, to be staying a second night, because that's not a cheap hotel. And it's a very, very interesting hotel because it's a very, very old building. I mean, it's about 500 years old, and it's got all these old interesting rooms full of, you know, wooden floorboards and four-poster beds and creaky old antiques. And it's just got atmosphere.
Yeah.
And on the second night, if I remember correctly, my wife had gone to bed, and it was weird. It was a strange, definitely a creepier vibe about it the second night. And I'd gone and made tea, and I was coming back to the bedroom, and there was a dog, what I perceived to be the noise of something scraping coming from the corridor behind me. And I was now trying to get into the bedroom with the mugs of tea in my elbow, pushing at this door handle, and a dog had come bolting round the corner towards me. And it was very, very quick, I mean, literally seconds, and it just stopped before me and vanished. And it was a great big Irish wolfhound. And I mean, it was quick. I mean, it wasn't like it was 5 seconds. It literally was boom, boom, gone. And I spilled tea everywhere. And oh God, I was jumped out through the roof. And I bolted into the bedroom and just louped into the bed and did the decent thing by pulling the covers over my head, more or less. You know, it wasn't very manly, but never mind. And Carol, I think, who'd remained asleep throughout this, was notified of all this in the morning, and she said to me at the time that she'd seen a guy wandering about at the foot of the bed also in the middle of the night, you know, in the semi-dark, who she had assumed was me getting up for some reason. And then she'd sort of felt me snoring eventually, because I'd fall asleep eventually, next to her. So that was very odd. So we asked the guy in the morning about, is it haunted? His name's Roxy. He came across and he says, oh yeah, blah, blah, blah. And recounted all these stories about people having similar experiences, and not with the dog, but just weird experiences, you know, people getting their bedclothes wrenched off them, all this kind of stuff. And people working there, having bad, you know, strange encounters. And it was great. It was interesting. But what was really weird was about, I think it must have been, God, it was 4 years ago or something, 3 years ago. It was just before COVID outbreak. I did a tour I used to do Airbnb tours, and I did a tour for this lady from the States, and it was a 2-hour ghost tour, I mean, a real solid ghost tour.
Yeah.
And I only do it for people that long if it's people that actually are really interested. And she claimed to be a psychic, so as she went around, she was telling me, oh, this happened here and whatever. And, you know, she was quite interesting what she was coming away with. But she got to the witchery, and after I told her that story, she just announced this. She said quite openly, well, I'll tell you why the dog is there. The dog's there because it's attracted to a hat in the bedroom that belonged to its owner while he was alive. And the hat is the middle one of three, and it sits at the foot of the bed in a cabinet. And I was standing there with my jaw hanging at this point, because at the foot of the bed is a cabinet with these three hats. And I actually had been wearing the hat the night before taking selfies. So that was interesting. So I often say to people, if you're going to stay in a hotel and there's any hats, you know, don't wear them. Pretty much. But that was pretty wild. And she said she'd never been to Edinburgh in her life, which was pretty astonishing.
But I
got a little bit of a shock that evening. I kind of laugh about it now, but at the time, I was a little bit nervous that evening.
Oh, brilliant. Well, Graham, it's a fantastic book, and I recommend it highly to anybody who wants to know more about,
well, thank you,
Edinburgh's haunted locations. It's well written. It's done with some really good humoured fun poking at yourself. Mm-hmm. And some of the locations and stories. Like I say, there's loads of up-to-date first-hand encounters and witnesses from all across the city. Where can everybody get hold of a copy, find your other work, and follow you online, my friend?
Oh, yeah. Well, I've got a Facebook page, and it's called The Haunted North Paranormal Scotland. And people can join that Facebook page, and it's a public group. And, you know, you're welcome to join and read more stories. If you want to get the book, you can get it off Amazon. I've got an Instagram page, which our account, which my I'm going to humiliate myself now, which my daughter set up for me, and I've got no idea what Instagram account is, but I have one. And but if folk want to get the book, they can get it through, like I say, Amazon, or they can contact me personally on my email, which is graham.m@live.co.uk. And if they're interested in discussing more or getting books, they can do, and I'll sign them. Other than that, if you have any questions or want to, you know, pass over any stories, for example, or, you know, I'm happy to take stories also. So whatever folks want, they can do. That's not a problem.
Brilliant. Well, thank you again, Graham. It's lovely to finally speak to you. Like I say, I've thoroughly enjoyed the book.
Thank you.
Whetted my appetite. As I was saying before we started our conversation, I'm finally visiting Edinburgh at Easter this year, so hopefully we'll get a chance to meet up show me the sights, and I'll buy you a pint or two to wet your whistle at the very least. I'm sure, no doubt, we'll find ourselves in the Banshee, I hope.
We will definitely be finding ourselves. That's definitely on the cards.
Brilliant. Well, listen, Graham, all the very best with it. Like I say, as I do for all my guests, I'll put links to everything in the show notes so people can track the book down and get in touch with you and find the Facebook page as well. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a real pleasure, and hopefully we'll speak again in the future.
All the best, Paul. Thanks, man. Take care.